Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 10. A New Hope. It was toward the end of March 1860 that Mary Patterson left North Groton. She got no further than Romney Station at the foot of the mountain road. There, Abigail found a temporary home for her and her husband at a boarding house kept by a Mr. and Mrs. John Herbert. Patterson does not appear to have been with her when the actual move was made, but evidently the plan worked out by the all-too-efficient Abigail was that in return for what she was doing in the way of financial rehabilitation, Patterson should make a serious effort to reform his ways and make a home for his wife. Daniel apparently accepted the proposition with alacrity. He was never hesitant about accepting any chance to begin anew. A new prospect fascinated him, for in his mind's eye, he could always see a new unfolding prosperity. When next there is any record of him, he is a gracious, exemplary presence in the Herbert home at Romney Station. He carries his invalid wife downstairs to all her meals and carries her back again and earns much approval for his devotion, while his Prince Albert coat and varnished boots and silk hat begin to attract attention and to inspire confidence in the minds of the patients who resort in increasing numbers to the office he had taken close by. For Daniel Patterson could always get work, and no man could be more suave and gracious, and even, it is to be imagined, lovable at times. He was just the kind of character that would be forgiven, not until 7 times, but until 70 times 7. His position, it must be admitted, was at no time an easy one. The contrast between the satisfying picture of married life as he had visioned it, and as it really was, must have been harsh enough. Daniel Patterson, married to the brilliant young widow, daughter of Squire Baker of Sandbutton, bringing her back to health and happiness through his care and skill, and winning the gratitude and admiration of the Bakers and Tiltons, and the envy of a good half dozen of his wife's former suitors, firmly established in his practice with a host of new patients. Such a picture, and one even brighter still, must always have made the reality dreary indeed. To win happiness from the situation, as it was, would call for a love and patience and an abiding satisfaction in unseen things, which Daniel Patterson did not possess, apparently. He had a way, however, of pouncing on anything in the passing stream which fitted in with his mood and making the most of it while it lasted. At such times he was at his best, and it was, no doubt, the constant renewal of these periods which made it possible for the two to stay together even as long as they did. The first few months at Romney seemed to have been just such a period for Daniel. It was not long before he had secured a little house where Mary could settle down to homemaking once again and get the full advantage of the coming spring and summer. The house was situated at Romney Village, back in the hills about a mile from Romney Station. It had a splendid view of the foothills and the mountains beyond, and with the blind girl, Myra Smith, once again her devoted servant and companion, and Daniel still all attention, Mary began to get better. So it was through the summer and winter, and then in the April of the following year, 1861, the whole face of things was changed by the outbreak of the Civil War. The war brought into the life of Mary Patterson a new, if tragic, interest. Always intensely patriotic, the fact that the whole struggle, at first, hinged on the question of secession, and on that question only, caused her to throw her devotion without any mental reserve on the side of the North. Whatever other right a state might have under the Constitution, there could be no doubt of the fact it had not the right to secede from the Union. Even on her sick bed, she could do something to help. She could knit socks and make lint. She could throw open her little home for meetings of the sewing circles. She could write for the press. And she could defend and explain the stand of the North in all its phases to her friends and neighbors. She seems to have done all of these things, and to have been, of course, all the better for it. It was only a temporary stimulus, it is true, but it made life more tolerable, opening up to the sick woman an opportunity for service, which all her life was literally a fundamental demand of her being. The effect of the war upon Daniel was to afford him the most reasonable excuse that had ever come his way for making a change. It is not sure he was consumed with patriotism. He was well over 40 and never particularly attracted by the prospect of high adventure, but he loved to be where things were happening, where he could meet with and talk to people who were doing things about which he in turn could talk. And the papers every day were full of such matters. And so, within a few months of the outbreak of the war, he was hard at work exploring every means of getting into the mainstream of events as any army doctor, if nothing better offered, but preferably on some special commission such as would bring him more varied opportunities. In the end, probably through the Tiltons, he received a commission from Governor Barry of New Hampshire to carry to Washington funds which had been collected in the state to aid Northern sympathizers in the South and attend to their distributions. It was exactly what Daniel wanted. He could see in his coming sojourn in Washington a most satisfying social round, which he would undoubtedly have opportunities for extending to an almost unlimited extent. In Washington, a Prince Albert coat, varnished boots, and a silk hat would be necessities. And so, in March of 1862, leaving Mary alone with the little blind girl, he set out for the front. A few months before he left, a strange new hope had come into Mary's life. The second quarter of the last century was a period of mental upheaval throughout the world, but especially in New England. The willingness to try anything once, which in later years became so characteristic of the Far West, was typical of New England at that time. It was an era of dynamic change. Railways were spreading themselves everywhere. Newspapers, turned out by machines, were starting up overnight in every town and village. The electric telegraph was on the way. Emerson and Longfellow, Whittier and Lowell, and a host of disciples were preaching new freedom and inevitably opening the way for the excesses of their virtues, while in the realm of the occult, mesmerism and spiritualism were among the stock subjects of conversation and eager inquiry. This was especially true of mesmerism. Since its first promulgation by Friedrich Anton Mesmer in 1766 in his book De Planetarum Influxu, mesmerism had swept into and out of popular interest several times. Its amazing domination of Paris just before the Revolution had been followed by complete discredit, and for 50 years or more, its practice was regarded as simple charlatanism. In the early 20s of last century, however, it began to creep back into serious notice, and in 1831, a committee of the Academy of Medicine of Paris reported favorably on magnetism as a therapeutic agent. 10 years later, James Braid, a surgeon of Manchester, England, in an able work on the subject, definitely brought the whole question back into the fold of scientific research. He renamed the phenomenon hypnotism, and the possibilities of magnetic sleep in the practice of surgery began to attract wide attention. At that time, hypnotism seemed to be in a fair way to becoming orthodox. But a few years later, the discovery of chloroform on the practical side and the sudden rise of spiritualism in the realm of mental phenomena tended to make mesmerism once more an outcast. The inevitable result of this neglect was to consign the practice once again to the hands of the charlatan, using the term in its broadest sense. The mesmerists who toured the towns and countrysides of New England so frequently in the second and third quarters of last century were often men of exceptional ability in their doubtful practice. But they were, first of all, showmen, with apparently one objective, to make as much money out of it as possible. The papers of the day were full of their advertisements, and if one were to judge from the claims those advertisements advanced, their powers were stupendous. They were, however, overshadowed in the mind of the public by the rapidly rising tide of spiritualism. In the middle of last century, spiritualism was spreading over the eastern United States like an epidemic, mainly on the strength of its appeal as the possible beginning of a new revelation. Spirit circles sprang up everywhere, and Andrew Jackson Davis' book, The Principles of Nature, Her Divine Revelation, which he declared had been dictated in clairvoyant trance, quickly attained the status of a textbook. Mary Patterson must have read all about both spiritualism and mesmerism. Indeed, this is evident from her later discussions. To one who was attracted, as she was, almost to the point of fascination, by the mental and even the spiritual side of homeopathy, their possibilities would almost necessarily appeal very strongly at first. All her life, however, Mary's great standby had been her Bible, and no doctrine survived in the end for her which was not, in its final analysis, justified by the Bible. Her search as she herself was wont to point out in later years, was for spirit, not spirits. During the latter part of her stay in North Groton, there began to appear in the papers, which came to her bedside, stories of amazing works of healing that were being done by one Phineas P. Quimby, a doctor in Portland, Maine. He was, it was clear at once from the various reports, no ordinary doctor. Indeed, he departed entirely from the ordinary paths of medicine, discarded drugs, and relied for his cures upon a new power which he designated wisdom. Mary Patterson must have read the early accounts of it with eagerness. It must have seemed to her to fit in exactly with the dim conclusions that had been forced upon her by her study of homeopathy. As she put it to herself later, less and less medicine until there is no medicine. Thus, in the Lebanon, New Hampshire Free Press of December 3, 1860, appeared a long article on this new form of healing. It was copied widely by other New England papers, and either the original issue in the Free Press, Lebanon is only some 20 miles from Rumney Station, or a copy of it must almost certainly have been seen and read by Mary Patterson, who was always an eager reader of newspapers. The opening paragraph of the article could hardly fail to rivet her attention, for it tells of the healing of a woman whose trouble must have seemed to be almost exactly her own. "Just at the present time," the article opens, "there is a good deal said about Dr. Quimby of Portland, and it may not be considered amiss to mention the case of a young lady of this town who has been greatly benefited by him. For nearly 3 years, she has been an invalid, a great part of the time confined to her bed, and never left the room unless carried out by her friends. A few weeks since, she heard of Dr. Quimby and resolved to visit him. She did so, and after remaining under his care 4 days, she returned home free from all the pain and disease, and is now rapidly regaining health and strength." The papers of the day were, of course, full of such cures, achieved in the most amazing and unaccustomed ways. Professor de Graaff's original electric oil and the celestial telegraph vied with spirits and all manner of manipulations to produce instantaneous cures for all and sundry ills. But this way was different. In the first place, the article in the Lebanon newspaper was not a paid advertisement. Neither was it written by Quimby himself, but by the editor of the paper or one of his staff, who evidently regarded the subject of sufficient importance to rank as news. The writer continues, and it is not difficult to imagine Mary Patterson's growing interest. "The reputation of Dr. Quimby as a man who cures disease has extended without the narrow limits of his own state, and the sick from various parts have learned to avail themselves of his services." The increasing respect and confidence of the public in his success suggests the day of miracles, and brings up a question as absurd as that of 2,000 years ago. Can any good come out of Nazareth? Can actual disease be cured by a humbug? Dr. Quimby effects his cures without the aid of medicine or outward applications, and his practice embraces cases like the above, where all ordinary treatment has failed to relieve. These facts, at first, place him in the rank of the mysteries of a superstitious world. But there are few of his patients, after a second interview, who do not think the mystery is in them and not in him. It is here that Dr. Quimby stands. His explanations and his cures go hand in hand. While his senses are penetrating the dark mystery of the sick, he is in complete possession of his consciousness as a man. Not fearing to investigate the operation of the mind, he penetrates the region where nothing but magicians, sorcerers, witchcraft, and spiritualists have ventured. In going far beyond them in his experiments, he arrives at the principle of regulating happiness. An article such as this, and there were many like it, would be sufficient to account for the interest that Dr. Quimby aroused in the mind of Mary Patterson. And she was immensely interested, so much so that in the October of 1861, on a rumor that Quimby was coming to Concord, she persuaded Patterson to write to him in Portland and state her case. It must have seemed to her almost a last chance, and she was determined to take it. And so Daniel wrote from Rumney on October 14th, offering to bring Mrs. Patterson up to Concord if he would exercise his wonderful power in her behalf whilst visiting that section for the benefit of the suffering portion of our race. Within a few days, a reply came from Quimby to the effect that he had not then any plans to visit Concord, but enclosing a printed circular which he was apparently in the habit of sending out in response to inquiries. It is a long and torturous document, and very possibly explains why the sick woman in Rumney waited another 9 months, as she did, before she wrote to Quimby again. This circular is a very businesslike one, wherein Dr. P.P. Quimby would respectfully announce to the citizens of fill in the blank and vicinity that he will be at the fill in the blank, where he will attend to those wishing to consult him in regard to their health. He then goes on to say that he gives no medicine and makes no outward applications, but simply sits down by the patients, tells them their feelings and what they think is their disease. If the patients admit that he is right, then the explanation he gives them is the cure. And if he succeeds in correcting their error, he changes the fluids of the system and establishes the truth or health. After several paragraphs devoted to severe strictures on orthodox medical practice, he concludes with a note as to fees. Referring again to his method, he says, "This can only be explained to patients, for which explanation his charge is, fill in the blank, dollars. If necessary to see them more than once, fill in the blank, dollars." What effect this circular, combined with all she had read about him, had upon Mary Patterson, is not known. That she did not at that time follow her inquiries further is clear from her subsequent letters. The probability is that the stimulus of the war all around her together with the preparations for her husband's departure for Washington, diverted her thoughts sufficiently to give her temporary relief. It was about this time, too, that she received a letter from her son, the first direct news she had from him since he was taken away from her some 8 years previously. This brought the great struggle more nearly home to her, for the letter told Mary that her son had enlisted in the army 2 years before, and how tremendously, with all the enthusiasm of a lad of 18, he was looking forward to going to the front. Mary wept over the letter and kissed it. Her hopes had been broken so often where her boy was concerned that she seems through these years to have had no heart to make further effort. She simply took what little comfort she could get when it came. She wrote to him, of course, and there is some evidence that he wrote to her more than once. But the war made any thought of their seeing each other again more improbable than ever. Meanwhile, Dr. Patterson had gone to Washington, and Mary settled down with her blind servant to make the best of things and to watch eagerly and anxiously, as did so many mothers and wives in those days, for letters. She did not have to wait long, for about the middle of April, she received one morning a letter from Abigail, enclosing a letter from Washington addressed to her husband, Hamilton Tilton. It was not from Patterson, but from one of his friends, and it told the absurdly pathetic story of how Daniel, all eager to see and hear all there was to be seen and heard, had driven out from Washington in a sulky with a party of friends to view the battlefield of Bull Run. How, going off on his own, he had strayed too near the Confederate lines and had been picked up by Stuart's cavalry and carried off, possibly on the suspicion of being a spy. No doubt, Abigail in her covering letter did her best to soften the shock, but it must have been severe enough in any case. The fate of a spy was summary, and the suspense might have gone hardly with Mary. But fortunately, within a day or two, she received a letter from Patterson himself from Libby Prison. A cheerful, incorrigible letter, the letter of a boy who has got himself into a scrape, but is secretly enjoying every moment of it. Due deference is paid to the solemnity and seriousness of the occasion, but it is impossible to escape the impression that Daniel was having a good time. He writes, "Dear wife, you will be amazed to learn that I am in prison, in the Confederate States prison. But it is so. I was taken 1 week ago today." He tells her not to be uneasy, as he is safe and that his fellow prisoners are friendly gentlemen. The letter is nothing if not tender, but an incongruous yet characteristic note is struck when he says, "I left my traveling bag and a new pair of boots at 381 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, at Mrs. C.W. Hayden's." He asks her to communicate with their representative in Congress, gives directions for reaching him in prison by letter, reasserts his concern for her welfare, and signs, "Your affectionate husband." Mary rose to the occasion, as she always did. She wrote at once to T.M. Edwards and he took the matter up with the Secretary of War. Nothing, however, could be done, as no prisoners were being exchanged. An appeal to her old friend Franklin Pierce was equally fruitless. There was nothing to do but wait, and when the stimulus of the new demands had passed, the old wretchedness descended upon her worse than ever before. In her extremity, she remembered Quimby. She wrote to him, begging him to come to Rumney and help her, as she could not go to him. It is a fear-racked, despairing letter, dated Rumney, May 29th of 62. The shock of her husband's capture, she writes, brought on a relapse just when she was getting well from a chronic disease which completely incapacitated her for a year at a time. Writing from bed, she begs him to visit her immediately, explaining, "I have entire confidence in your philosophy as read in the circular sent my husband, Dr. Patterson." But Dr. Quimby was unable to come to her, and Mary turned to her sister Abigail for help. She now had one purpose and one purpose only in mind, to get to Dr. Quimby. For it seems certain from subsequent events that she had already begun that process, so evident later on, of reading into Quimby's philosophy what she most desired to find there. Throughout her long years, Mrs. Eddy's great source, at once of strength and vulnerability, lay in just this facility with which she endowed those associated with her with the qualities she most desired to find in them. As she herself put it some 24 years later, after many bitter experiences, "It has always been my misfortune to think people bigger and better than they really are." This accounts, in a measure perhaps, for the amazing sudden ruptures of friendships with which her life and career are punctuated. The friend of yesterday would suddenly appear before her for what indeed he had always been, while the spiritual genius would be seen for what he always was, just another human being of common clay. Dr. Quimby was the first and perhaps the most notable example of this tendency. When she wrote to him in her despair from Rumney, she had quite evidently worked through to an estimate of him far ahead of desert, and one she did not have when her husband had written some 9 months previously. Abigail's response to her appeal was instant, as it always was, and when she drove over from Sandbutton to Rumney, she insisted that Mary go back with her there until Dr. Patterson should be released. Mary readily acceded to the proposal. She was determined somehow to get to Portland to see the man who she was convinced could help her. And Abigail, she felt sure, would make it possible. This decision gave her new strength. Instead of having to be carried to the carriage, as Abigail had evidently expected she would have to be, she rose and dressed herself, and the two set out together on the long drive back to Sandbutton. On the way, Mary told her sister of her great desire. Abigail was utterly shocked. Quimby was nothing but a charlatan, or worse still, a mesmerist. She would not think of helping any sister of hers to go to him. Nothing is known for certain of Mary's impressions on returning to Sandbutton after an absence of nearly 10 years, or of the wretchedness of her own thoughts as she contemplated the burden of making yet another effort at a fresh beginning. She did make the effort, of course. Within a few weeks, Abigail had arranged a new plan, down to the last detail, as she had arranged so many other things in the past. Mary was to go to Dr. Vail's Water Cure Sanatorium at Hill, New Hampshire. Abigail provided her with a suitable companion and nurse, a young woman named Susan Ward, made all the provisions for a comfortable journey, supplied her with the necessary funds, saw her on her way, and felt sure that all would be well. Mary agreed to everything without protest. Hill was nearer to Portland than was Sandbunton, and Mary was determined, somehow or other, to get to Portland.